They say that one person's trash is another person's treasure, and nothing proves that point like a trip to the local used bookstore. On my podcast, Half Price Horror, I take a trip every episode to that store and come back with horror movies ranging from genre classics to obscure cult gems and everything in between. Then I do a deep dive discussion into their stories, their themes, and some of the things that make them unique. I hope you'll join me, because at Half Price Horror, we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Available wherever Anchor podcasts can be found.
Hey everybody, a quick bit of business right here at the top of the show. So this segment was recorded after the fact. The episode of The Blob has been semi in the can for probably about 3 weeks. I apologize. Once again, our June offering was delayed, and now you're getting the film in July, and at this rate, even towards the end of July. So once again, proof that this particular year seemed squarely lined up against me, as if it was designed purposefully to keep me from getting my shit together. My day job has undoubtedly been very busy. I've been planning a vacation. Me and my wife are going to go and take a much-needed quick little jaunt out to Las Vegas, but honestly, the real issue that's caused this latest round of delays would be the sad passing of Script Girl and Chief Audio Technical Dachshund, one Miss Bernadette. And that's been an incredibly hard pill to swallow around here as of late. No need to tell people who knew her, but she's a fabulous dog, and she's already impossibly missed, but to her credit, she gave us 15 and a half years of laughs and snuggles and a very wiggly butt, and for the purposes of this show, lots and lots of snoring in the background of recorded episodes, including this one. So, yeah, once again, I apologize. It was not my intention to make this seemingly entire season catch-as-catch-can, that series of offerings that we're going to be putting forward, but I kind of feel like we're going to be playing it fast and loose for at least the foreseeable future, because that's the only way I can keep doing these without permanently stopping, and I don't want to stop. So for everybody out there listening, thank you. We really appreciate your patience, and thank you for continuing to tune in and listen to us when you can and when we have something to listen to. And I appreciate it. Love you, Bernie.
Lend me $5 till tomorrow, okay?
What for?
And you know, you're not the only one with a date tonight, pal. I'm gonna score with Vicky tonight. I want to invest in a little protection. Come on.
Let's go, boys. It's closing time.
All right. Let's make it quick.
Look, pal, give me a pack of Trojans and a Banaka spray.
Skonczewski.
Reverend.
Good game today.
Thanks. Thanks, Reverend. How are you?
Well, hay fever's acting up a little bit, but I'll live. Yeah. I haven't seen you at the Sunday services lately.
Oh,
you want the ribbed or the regular?
Ribbed? I guess. They're not for me, you know. They're for my friend.
Oh?
There's this sort of naive girl that he's planning on, well, you know. And, I insisted that he take precautions.
Why doesn't he pay for them?
I had to drag him down here as it is. I mean, the guy is totally irresponsible.
Hey, come on, Scott. What's the holdup? I can't keep this girl waiting.
The boy doesn't need condoms. He needs a muzzle.
Hi, I'm here to see Meg.
Well, come on in. Meg will be right down. Won't you sit down? Oh, excuse me. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Are you surviving my family so far?
Yeah. You look great.
Thank you.
You want to go?
Sure. I just want you to meet my dad really quick. It'll just take a second.
Sure.
Daddy, I'd like you to meet my friend Paul.
Ripped.
I saw it. on Linden Street. Well, hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding and appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater, where we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. Now, this isn't your standard film review. Rather, it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with some background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Now, fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you want to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review, subscribe. We're continuing our theme, that's Superior Remake Summer, and that's going to be our salute to some cinematic remakes that we feel really outshine their source material. And this week sees us glide by with the 1988 sci-fi horror cult classic, The Blob. Join us! Set the scene. It's 1990. I had, by way of the good old local WPWR TV Power 50 Saturday matinee, caught, I'll say about 75% of the original film The Blob, which I very much enjoyed, all at the tender age of 8. I thought I was getting a rather fun offering, albeit it's still something I wouldn't have told my folks that I had gone out of my way to watch. I was just downstairs playing Legos in front of the TV. What did they care? But then, as was apt to happen, WFLD Fox 32 proudly touted that it was going to be making the premiere of the network showing of the 1988 remake of The Blob as the Saturday night movie offering. And to do so, they ran a series of commercial bumpers using both the trailer and another one that sticks out in my mind as being both genius and quite disturbing to young Chris. They played an edited but still effective portion of the infamous drain scene, where a man is working in a kitchen and trying to release a clog in an industrial sink before he finds himself violently pulled down the drain by said blob in a rather gruesome fashion. The screen then cut to a placard touting that the blob would be shown in the coming week, with glowing lettering and eerie music, and I was both fascinated and repelled with fear. Later, I would see the film in its entirety when I was in high school, and I fell in love with all of it all over again, both for its wit and how it zigs when everybody expects it to proverbially zag. But truthfully, if we're going to get into reasons why I think this film is a superior remake, we have to first discuss the progenitors, and of course the original film that inspired this all. This was not the first film to cover the topic of, I guess the genre would be creeping horror. Indeed, the radio horror program Lights Out did a premiere radio broadcast of The Chicken Heart back in 1937, something that I had always thought, at least initially, was just a goofy riff that Bill Cosby was kind of playing and hamming up when he was talking about the subject on his 1966 comedy album, Wonderfulness. Until I did a little digging and I made a rather delightful discovery. It was a real episode of that show.
Do you remember some time ago in an Eastern scientific institution, they kept a piece of heart alive for weeks on end? Well, I got to thinking, what if that heart began to grow? And grow, and grow, grow.
Hello? Hello, operator. Give me Mr. Regan, fast. Hello, Mr. Regan, this is Lewis. Listen, get me a rewrite, man. The thing's still growing. No, Chief, I tell you the truth. The corridor's choked with living, crawling flesh. No, 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 I'm not drunk. I'm telling you the truth. That little piece of flesh has grown until now. It's jamming that building. All inside the space of an hour. You've got to believe me. It's the greatest news story of the generation, and here you argue with me. I tell you it's the truth. You've got to believe
me. You must believe me. I tell you the only hope is to burn the building to the ground at once.
Now, wait a minute, Doc. Wait a minute. Take it easy.
I tell you, burn it to the ground. Burn.
And I tell you, take it easy. I sent in a call.
Oh, don't you understand? For some reason, I cannot even imagine. This tissue is doubling in size every hour. Do you know what that means? In another hour, it will be twice the size it is now. And long before that, it will break open the building with the force of its pressure. And then it will be free in the street. Do you hear me? Free in the street. And then those tentacles of protoplasm stretching out to feed on anything they can reach.
What's happening?
The building! See the walls! Cracking! I warned you! I warned you! I tried to warn them. But now it is too late. The heart is free.
Now, honestly, how's that for a slice of fried gold? It really puts Cosby's routine into perspective, which, again, I have to say, I always thought was just hyperbole. I thought he was just riffing on a silly concept. But no, once again, truth proves itself to be stranger than fiction. I mean, really, behold.
And welcome to Lights Out. Tonight's episode is about a chicken heart. A chicken heart that ate up New York City. The chicken heart was kept alive in a laboratory in a vat. Special solution. Half blood, half sodium salicylate. Careless janitor knocked the vat over. He went to get a rag to clean it up. The chicken heart grew. 6'5". And in search of human blood. Janitor came back, opened the door. The heart ate him up.
What?
It moved out into the hallway. Rang for the elevator. Fourth floor.
Ah!
Moved out into the street. Ate up all the cabs. The Empire State Building. Ate up the Jersey Turnpike. It's in your home state. It's outside of your door. And it's going to eat you up.
The concept of the blob itself has been apocryphally attributed to an incident that occurred in Philadelphia in 1950 that made the local news. Two police officers who were out on patrol one night saw, quote, a large quivering mass of jelly that seemed to be 6 feet across and about a foot thick in the center. Just hanging out in the middle of a street. Apparently, it was perceived as giving off some sort of dull purple glow, but when the officers interacted with it, it just sort of sloughed off and began to dissolve into scummy liquid. This so-called star jelly has actually been encountered by humanity all over the world since we basically started walking around upright and deciding to pay attention to our surroundings. Incidentally, this natural occurrence is most commonly attributed to one of two sources. First, it's perceived to be either a slime mold, you know, those single-celled eukaryotic organisms that tend to clump together as they feed on decaying plant matter, or, second, as you probably already have guessed, the disgorged amphibian oviducts that predatory birds leave. Oh, that's right. You didn't know that? You see, female frogs, seasonally in the autumn months, they begin to form these egg clutches within their ovaries, and they coat them with this jelly that keeps them safe. Predators during this time go out hunting for frogs, they eat them, and then they subsequently throw up these frog ovaries, which, when they're disgorged, are colored translucent white, and all of those purple and black eggs get disgorged as well. And their contact with moisture on the ground from the grass causes that jellied ovum suspension to exponentially start to expand, which creates this carpet of gelatinous mass, and, oh, let's just use a technical term, I'm gonna call it glop. Who's hungry? This supposedly is something that got independent film producer and filmmaker Jack H. Harris inspired, and he thought he could use this as a vehicle to crank out a sci-fi film that folks, at least at the time, would enjoy seeing. He retained an actress turned writer, Kay Linkletter, also known as Kate Phillips, and writer Theodore Simonson to help pen him a script that would talk about some sort of very creeping horror. Initially, The Blob was submitted to be The Molten Meteor, telling a story about a small Pennsylvanian town that finds itself slowly being menaced by a sort of gelatinous but carnivorous alien creature that grows larger with every meal it has. Local teens, of course, encounter it and try to warn the town elders of the danger, but they're brushed off, at least until the threat becomes too large to ignore. Eventually, they manage to freeze the entity and ship it to the Arctic, noting that, hey, now they're all collectively safe. Well, at least as long as things stay cold in the Arctic, of course. And to think, folks didn't care about the effects of climate change back in the day. Pshaw. The title would end up being changed based on a throwaway line that Linkaker said, referring to the creature itself as The Blob during production. Some others offer up different origin stories, but those can't be substantiated, so I'm going to stick with giving Miss Linkaker all the credit.
Been killed.
Doc Hallen, what happened?
It's over at his place. You gotta come now.
Oh, wait a minute, Steve. Tell us what happened.
Well, I'm trying to tell you. Now, this thing had killed the doc.
But what was it? Stop with it, kid. Well, it's kind of like a... It's kind of like a mass that keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Every one of you watching this screen, look out. Because soon, very soon, the most horrifying monster menace ever conceived will be oozing into this theater. Teenagers see it first, like a falling star from outer space.
Boy, that was close. Hey, come on, I want to see if I can find it.
An old man finds it, touches it, and this is the shocking result. From then on, there's no stopping the blob as it spreads from town to town. It's indestructible. It's indescribable. Nothing can stop it.
This town is in danger.
How can it be stopped? Mob hysteria sweeps one city. Before long, the nation and then the world could fall before the blood-curdling threat of the Blob.
Starring Steve McQueen and a cast of exciting young people.
¶¶
Now, the 1958 Blob movie was made on the cheap for about an estimated $110,000. It was shot in several sleepy little Pennsylvania towns in the Valley Forge region. And, at least at the time, it didn't have any big-name actors attached to it. And it rejected the space opera formula that previous sci-fi offerings had put up, instead deciding to focus on playing up the horror of the otherness of the amorphous, gelatinous alien blob. In reality, though, Paramount Pictures ended up buying the distribution rights for the film for $300,000, and in a rather interesting move, they doubled down on their investment. They spent an additional $300,000 on marketing the picture, advertising it heavily in key markets, and releasing it on a double bill with another cheap sci-fi film, I Married a Monster from Outer Space, which, sidebar, it's indeed a fun film in its own right, and you should see it. The final effect, 1958's Blob, would go on to become a genuine national hit, where it would gross more than $4 million at the box office, and it was so successful, Harris, a few years later, would buy back the rights to his own movie to pair it with the next film that he decided to make, which was a fun little stop-motion animation picture called Dinosaurs. Another fun one for another time. Now, perhaps it would seem to be a run-of-the-mill monster movie when we look back on it today, but in reality, for its time, 1958's The Blob had a lot going for it that made it really atypical for the era of drive-in tomfoolery. It was filmed in tantalizing, lurid technicolor, all the better to see that gelatinous red menace pop before the audience with its jello-inspired glory. It's offering up a 28-year-old Steve McQueen, the fucking king of cool himself, moonlighting as a good-natured rebellious teen who goes out of his way time and time again to attempt to warn his fellow town elders that there's a very real, very sticky threat out there that's attempting to envelop the entire location. McQueen, for his part, would end up kicking himself because he, when he took the role, demanded cash up front for his work, earning a cool $3,000 for his acting, rather than taking the initial offer that Harris had floated for him of getting 10% of the film's profits. You know, you live, you learn. The only other big name that would stand out to anybody who listens to this show, and I know all six of yous are out there, that would be Annetta Corsat, who would go on to have a really strong television career playing the role of Helen Crump, later Taylor, the school teacher and eventual wife of Sheriff Andy Taylor on The Andy Griffith Show. And she would work later with Griffith again, having several roles in the late 80s and early 90s on Matlock. Corsat plays Steve McQueen's love interest here, and for working with this level of material, again, she sells it, at least far better than it probably deserved. But the original Blob wasn't all just good-looking actors and killer jello. An additional touch of class could be found in the production, and that would be the inclusion of none other than Burt Bacharach, who composed the film's campy yet fun song, Beware of the Blob, which of course would be performed by the group The Five Blobs, much to the public's delight, making the oozing terror a novelty radio hit.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor. Right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
Blob was apparently in the zeitgeist of just the general fears of humanity, at least towards some sort of crawling gelatinous horror of the day. Because the summer of 1958 saw the release of another film, Ishiro Honda's, of Godzilla fame, his version of The H-Man, which is about a melted monstrosity that absorbs the local populace. And then, of course, you'd have your knockoffs, and it would come as no surprise that The Blob had an inspired hit like Cal Tiki, the immortal monster, in 1959, which, of course, happened just to be an Italian monster flick. What does copyright mean, anyhow? And that was directed by a young Mario Bava. Now, I can say for that one, it's indeed a fun film, and for the record, I do own it. Cal Tiki is about an amorphous creature that's found out in the Mayan ruins, worshipped as a god by the past people, and was said to have come with the passing of a comet. Hey, wait a minute, this sounds familiar. But before you could say, wait a minute, let's get a lawyer, multiple blobs start attacking and consuming the good people of Mexico City, and soldiers are called out with flamethrowers to fight the menace. Good times. But for all of its low-budget success, it would really be another 14 years before anybody came around to bring up a sequel to The Blob. And once again, an independent production, which was written by Jack Harris's son, Anthony, with the senior Harris still producing all of it, a pre-Dallas, post-I Dream of Jeannie Larry Hagman would step in to say, sure, I'm going to direct a sequel. The 1972 sequel, initially entitled Beware, The Blob, later re-released as Son of Blob, got its cinematic tongue firmly embedded in its proverbial cheek when they were making it, and became sort of a weird hybrid horror comedy. It was loaded with character actors and comedians, guys like Richard Stahl, Garrett Graham, Dick Van Patten, Godfrey Cambridge, Shelley Berman, Del Close, Burgess Meredith, and Cindy Williams. It's honestly a rather strange offering, to be sure. And yes, like all the things we seem to talk about here, I have that one as well in the LSC vault. It's an interesting story. You got an oil pipeline worker that goes to the North Pole, and then he returns back home to Los Angeles when his tour of duty is done, unaware that he's carried with him a small sample of the larger frozen blob from the last movie. And of course, the California sun proves to be just the ticket to reanimate our hungry, viscous alien, and a strange mix of comedy and horrific consumption ensues. The sequel was made on an estimated budget of $150,000, and it had a decent run on the drive-thru circuit, but it would later find new life as a video rental, especially in the 80s, when the box art would try to tempt fans by saying, "Come and see the film that JR shot," capitalizing off of Larry Hagman's famous Dallas plotline. It would also then be only a scant 16 years later when another enterprising young filmmaker would come along with dreams about updating some oozing terror. A young man by the name of Chuck Russell. Now, Chuck Russell was an up-and-coming Chicagoan who was raised on classic comedy films and who had a love for both theater and the madcap antics of Second City improv. He would later admit that he had gotten a fake ID to make himself look older so he could apply to be a part of the legendary comedy troupe, meeting with comedy legends of the day, John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, and Del Close. Russell himself had attended the University of Illinois, where he studied theater arts and writing, and then he made the transition to Los Angeles, where he started to study to become a filmmaker. Russell would end up cutting his teeth as a production assistant at Stunts Unlimited, and from there, he worked his way up to becoming an assistant director. He had some early success penning a script for the 1984 sci-fi film Dreamscape, that is going to be a future episode for sure, because that movie's awesome. And he gained some real traction there. Starting out alone, he would eventually team up with another young man who would become a frequent writing collaborator. You know, a no-name guy who just went by the moniker of Frank Darabont. They met while they were both working on the 1981 Linda Blair horror picture Hell Night, where Russell would have the opportunity to become an executive producer. Together, they formed a collaboration and partnership that would serve both of them very well. You see, Russell had always wanted the chance to play with some IP of his own, and he had actually reached out independently to producer Jack Harris, who still owned the original rights to The Blob, to see what could be done about having a remake made. Russell, and hey, maybe this is why I like him so much, viewed The Blob as a great opportunity. Yardy had a movie that was a lot of fun, but he himself had recognized that the original 1958 offering was not really, well, let's face it, a great piece of cinema, but it was something that was, again, fun and could be improved on. He wanted to make a version that, in his own words, could be more fun, far scarier, and actually colorful. And with a script that was penned by both him and Darabont, they decided this was going to be their next vehicle, and they pitched it to New Line Cinema. The response? Well, it was something akin to, interesting story, not interested. New Line, however, did not close the door on the duo. You see, right at that time, the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, while it was still profitable, was looking for some new blood to give the series momentum post the first sequel, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge. The two would pair up to work on writing a third sequel for the film, which would ultimately become The Dream Warriors, with Russell being offered the opportunity to direct that project. Both, of course, leapt at the chance. I mean, it's the mid-80s, why wouldn't you? And, not surprisingly, they had a hit with it. Now, with a little bit of success under their belts, The Blob was suddenly a property that people were interested in, and it would ultimately get greenlit by a studio called Cinema Group Pictures. Russell had his opportunity to reframe the story of a menace that came from outer space, yet a darker twist would be inserted in this telling, because you can't have a Cold War picture, not a horror picture during the days of Reagan, without a little government conspiracy. And so, The Blob was going to be a man-made, weaponized bit of technology gone wrong that would come back to threaten our heroes. A creature that wasn't just solely a gelatinous mass. Rather, it was a dynamic being, which would operate sort of like, well, as Russell had said, a stomach turned inside out, that would go on to melt and absorb its victims with some sort of corrosive acid as it devoured them. Armed with a budget of about $10 million, Russell set out to create a horror favorite for a new generation of viewers. For casting, they went with Kevin Dillon, now, of course, of Entourage fame. He was singled out to play the rebellious and wayward youth Brian Flagg. At the time, Dillon was still trying to make a name for himself. He had just completed working on Oliver Stone's Platoon, where he was in the role of the psychotic soldier Bunny. This was really his opportunity to carry a mainstream film, and while he was excited at the prospect, he actually didn't care for the hair extensions that they required him to wear to look the part of the sort of long-haired motorcycle-riding rebellious youth, which would set him up as a contrast to these other clean-cut high schoolers. Still, he does okay here. Next, in your role for the heroine, you have Shawnee Smith, who most of you now would know from the Saw series. She was cast to play the role of Meg Penny, the fresh-faced cheerleader who finds herself unwittingly turned into our story's heroine. At the time, Smith hadn't really done much. She had shown up in the background as a dancer in the 1982 musical Annie, and she had a few television appearances under her belt and a small role in 1986's Iron Eagle before she was cast here. Jeffrey DeMunn, that's going to be a Frank Darabont regular as the years would roll on, he came onto the production as a last-minute substitute, where he accepted the role as Sheriff Geller, simply as a paycheck to support his family. But really, this role provided him an opportunity to meet Darabont himself, the man who he would continue to work with over the next four decades. You have Candy Clark, by now touting her own gravitas after starring in John Huston's Fat City, and of course earning an Academy Award nomination for her role in George Lucas's American Graffiti. She was cast here to play Fran, the kindly diner owner who watches out for Brian and acts sort of as a potential love interest for Sheriff Geller. For the role of Reverend Meeker, Russell wanted somebody who could embody both the sense of piousness and creepiness at the same time. A man who would become obsessed by the blob by way of biblical prophecy, and he needed to do it in a, well, comical, funny fashion. So Russell had immediately thought of his favorite Second City improv stalwart, Del Close, who himself had already appeared in a small role back in 1972's Beware the Blob. Throw in Donovan Leach, that's the son of musician Donovan of Mellow Yellow fame, Joe Seneca, Bo Billingsley, and a series of cameo parts for Jack Nance, Bill Moseley, and Erica Alekia, and you have yourself here a really marvelous cast. Now, when it came to the creature itself, no longer would the blob be this slow-moving, jello-like entity. No, instead, what you're going to get here is a dynamic, fast-moving, pulsating, tendril-launching creature that would be brought to the screen by use of practical effects, miniature work, and, for the time, some really rudimentary CGI effects, which all came together to create a disturbing amoeba on the prowl. Here's the problem, though, that Russell faced. He needed multiple, and I mean truly multiple, blobs, because every time the creature consumes somebody or something, it ends up changing its shape and getting bigger. Plus, it needs to be able to access different locations, you know, come in through a window, a vent, a sewer pipe. So that would create this real problem that they have to make new blobs for every single scene that it's in. What does he do? He turns to special effects artist Tony Gardner, a man who had originally cut his teeth first working for Rick Baker on the set of the Thriller video for Michael Jackson, and he would go on to helm the team that would create the blob. Gardner's solution was to be about as low-tech as you can possibly get. Multiple blobs, which were loosely contained in what Russell would eventually jokingly refer to as prom dresses, they would stitch them into these malleable, airbrushed, painted silk bags that they then piped full of methyl cellulate. Yes, yes, you people of a certain age would recognize it's that same emulsified thickening agent that you can find in milkshakes, gels, lubricants, cosmetics, and of course, it's the main ingredient in the bulk laxative Metamucil. They pump that in, and then they would coat that, air quotes, prom dress with KY jelly to make it appear slimy. And that would create what the special effects team would lovingly call the blob quilt. On camera, it looked great, but it created a new problem for production. Because you see, methyl cellulate, which bulks up the blob, when you pump that stuff in and add water to it, it's incredibly heavy. Director Russell would later speculate that at its largest, it was over 1,000 pounds, while special effects artist Peter Abramson, who worked on the project, would comment that at any given time, the quilt was at a minimum of 200 to 300 pounds. Russell himself would later opine that it was like trying to wrangle a waterbed. So he was forced to deal with all of the sorts of unpredictable nature of movement that would happen when filming. And then, to combat this, he would end up doing the very same thing that the creators of the 1958 blob did to make it appear to move. He would run his images in reverse. To create tendrils and the bulky appendages that the blob would send forward, polyurethane would end up being cast into, well, tendril shapes, and then again smeared with methyl cellulate and KY lubricant, and then it would be launched forward in attacks. These snagging tendrils would happen by placing foam, again coated in methyl cellulate, around its potential victims, or, to make them chase after the victims, they would fire them from air mortars, or, for you sports fans, t-shirt cannons, to make sure they could quickly reach their targets. The film was shot on location in Abbotville, Louisiana, from January of 1988 through May of that same year, and the little town was perfect to double for a sleepy Northern California ski town, and especially from an economic standpoint, the production coming there truly was a boon to the locals, who were experiencing an economic downturn in the mid-1980s. For the cast and crew, though, it was a real logistical problem. You see, the Gulf of Mexico was not known for having snow, averaging only about 43 degrees during its coldest months in the winter, at least at that point in history. Production would eventually retain the services of one Pelican Ice Company out of New Orleans, purchasing tons of snow to create the effects for the snowmaker at the end of the film. Cast and crew members enjoyed their time on location, shooting at night, sleeping during the day, and enjoying lots of seafood at the local eateries. The final sewer scenes, however, would end up being shot back in California on a soundstage, a cover that took 3 days, where cast and crew were forced to run up and back over and over again in over 4 feet of water in rubber waders, just to complete that climactic chase scene. Russell was pushed hard to get the film completed by the end of May to make a summer of 88 release, and to his credit, he ended up hiring 2 editors on the project to get the footage cut together. But even though he was working at breakneck speed, another final snag would occur when the distributor, Cinema Group Pictures, announced they were going bankrupt. Thankfully, TriStar Pictures was able to step in and agree to distribute the film itself, allowing for production to keep on schedule and to have a summer of 1988 release, now bumped back to August. All that being said, dear God, folks, you've heard me gas on so long. How's about I stop flapping my gums and we get to that trailer? What do you say?
If it had a mind, you could reason with it. If it had a body, you could shoot it. If it had a heart, you could kill it. Now, man is no longer the supreme being on this planet.
The organism is growing at a geometric rate. By all accounts, it's at least 1,000 times its original mass.
Nobody believes me about what happened tonight.
What did happen?
You were there, you saw.
Plasmid, life form that hunts its prey. Predator.
I want that organism alive.
I think you ticked it off.
On a clear autumn night in the bucolic little ski town of Arborville, California, a meteorite crashes down at the edge of the tree line. A homeless man, collecting cans, as played by Billy Beck, goes to investigate the scene, and he's shocked to discover a sphere-like object has landed, and in front of him cracks open. He finds himself quickly attacked by a fast-moving gelatinous entity that adheres to his hand, causing him great pain and apparently feeding on him slowly. First, he stumbles across a local young tough named Brian Flagg, who's played by Kevin Dillon, who is just happening to be repairing his motorcycle nearby. Brian stops the can man from self-amputating his arm with a hatchet and chases after the delirious vagrant, trying to give him help. The two of them then stumble out into the road, where they're almost struck by one Meg Penny, as played by Shawnee Smith, and Paul Taylor, as played by Donovan Litch, who themselves are out on a date. Initially arguing over what to do, the three youths end up taking the man to the hospital, where he is shuffled into the back and placed on a cot. Meg and Paul stay to fill out paperwork, while Brian leaves to go try to retrieve his bike. In the short time they're in the hospital, Paul walks back to check on the man and ends up calling for the doctor, Jack Nance, revealing that the creature has consumed over half of the homeless man's body. Paul runs into a private office to phone the police, not realizing that he too is slowly being stalked and eyed up as the creature's next meal.
Sheriff's Department.
Get me the sheriff. It's an emergency.
Paul?
Sheriff, this is Paul Taylor.
Oh, what's wrong?
I'm at the Orvinville Hospital. An old man's just been killed down here.
You said killed?
Yes, sir.
You sit tight, I'll be right down. And who else is involved?
I'm with Meg Penny. And Brian Flagg was here earlier.
Flagg? Where is he now?
The now visibly bigger blob drops down from the ceiling and begins to consume Paul, dragging him slowly out the hospital window. His screams of pain alert Meg, who runs back and attempts to pull him to safety, only to have Paul's right arm come off. Meg ends up being thrown against the doorframe and is knocked out as the creature makes off into the night with what's left of the varsity football player. Meg is eventually picked up by her parents, but deemed hysterical by the authorities, while Brian, being the local troublemaker, is arrested. Deputy Briggs, as played by Paul McCrane, wants to try to pin this all on him, but Sheriff Geller, as played by Jeffrey DeMunn, is wise enough to realize that, yeah, Flagg's a punk, but clearly he's not a murderer, he didn't do this. And they end up letting him go, and start to prepare for a long night of having to deal with uncovering who is exactly behind these murders. Meg is equally upset because she saw Brian get hauled off in a police car, and because nobody believes her about the creature she saw. She ends up escaping her familial home, and then meets up with the young biker, planning at first on paying his bail, but seeing that they let him go, the two end up ducking into a local diner, ran by the kindly Fran, as played by Candy Clark, who serves the two teens a snack, even though it's way past closing time. And they start chatting about what they actually experienced.
Nobody believes me about what happened tonight.
What did happen?
You were there, you saw.
All I saw was an old man with a funky hand. That's all I saw. Thanks.
Can I get you something, hon?
No, thank you.
The thing on that man's hand killed him, and then it killed Paul. And whatever it is, it's getting bigger.
Is that what you told the cops? Do you mind if I ask you a personal question? I know you're the homecoming queen type and all, but are you strung out on something or what?
You're just the same.
What are you talking about?
You act like you're different. You put on this big show. But you're just like everybody else in this town. You're full of shit, Flag!
Brian is skeptical of Meg's creature talk, until diner employee George, as played by Clayton Landy, is violently sucked down the drain by the blob in front of Fran and the kids. Brian and Meg are able to escape the hungry alien by hiding in the freezer, its tendrils negatively reacting to the extreme cold. Fran ends up breaking out through a window and runs up the alley to a payphone booth in an effort to call the sheriff for help, initially not noticing that the now very large blob is enveloping the phone booth itself. As she desperately attempts to contact help, she's horrified to see a partially dissolving Sheriff Geller, who's already been consumed, float past the booth's window before it itself implodes under the creature's weight and Fran is engulfed. Brian and Meg end up escaping the walk-in freezer, where they run to the sheriff's office, only to find that Geller is gone and his deputies have been sent out to the initial crash site. While the teens race out there to find help, a boozy Reverend Meeker, as played by Del Close, sees the blob leaving the phone booth and retreating into the sewer. Noting that the diner has been destroyed, he walks in and works his way back to the walk-in freezer, calling out to anyone. And that's where he finds crystallized bits of the blob, and he collects them in a hinged mason jar. The kids arrive out at the site to find Deputy Briggs, and they're shocked instead to discover that the military is already there, sporting white hazmat suits and surrounding them with guns drawn.
Put those weapons down. We're here to help you.
Babe?
Meg
Penny?
Are you a resident of Arborville, Meg?
Yes, I am.
You experienced any vomiting, nausea, or diarrhea?
Hey, back off, huh? Hey, pal, you want to fill us in?
Who the hell are you people?
I'm Dr. Meadows. We're a government-sanctioned biological containment team.
Biological containment?
We're microbe hunters, young lady.
What? What are you doing here, boy? The men from Gladiator are showing us how to keep our leftovers fresh.
People are here on serious business. They don't have time for your bullshit, understand?
Colonel, has the deputy been briefed in detail?
Yes, sir. We're just heading back to town now to get things started.
Spend it. Colonel Hargis will arrange an escort.
What is going on over there?
That's the source of our worries. A troublesome souvenir from space.
What?
A meteorite. Don't get too close. There's danger of contamination.
I don't understand.
Let me tell you a story. The dinosaurs ruled our planet for millions of years. And yet they died out almost overnight. Why? The evidence suggests that a meteor fell to Earth bearing an alien bacteria.
Plague? Is that what this whole thing is about?
Prevention.
And you think this meteor brought some kind of a killer germ?
It's something I've expected and prepared for all my life.
Well, your meteor brought something, all right. But if it's a germ, it's the biggest son of a bitch you've ever seen.
While they're chatting, Meadows explains that they're all under quarantine, and he's placing the entire town under military control. Meg at first wants to trust the team, but Brian points out, we don't know who they actually are. They could be anybody. And basically assesses that this whole thing stinks. He breaks out of the van that they're placed in, but Meg opts to stay, noting that she wants to be reunited with her family. The military then begins taking people from their homes in town and gathering them all together in front of the town hall, where Meg is indeed reunited with her parents, as played by Art LaFleur and Sharon Spellman. But they can't find her younger brother, Kevin, as played by Michael Kenworthy. Apparently he and his buddy, Eddie, as played by Douglas Emerson, have lied to their parents to sneak out to the local theater to watch a slasher film. And while Meg's father argues with an officer about sending somebody to go collect his son, Meg ends up sneaking off to find her brother herself. During this time, we are intercut with scenes of the blob infiltrating the theater's ventilation system by way of the sewers. It first consumes projectionist Hob, as played by Frank Collinson, and then it quickly devours the theater manager, as played by Pons Marr. And their screams are covered up by the projected horror film's natural noise. The blob, which is now fairly massive, begins to pour out of the projection booth's slot and down the theater's walls, shooting tendrils out to consume members of the crowd. A panic ensues, and Meg arrives just in time to be stampeded by panicking patrons attempting to flee. She eventually locates Kevin and Eddie and manages to shepherd them through the back alley into the sewer, only to have the blob continue to give chase. Brian heads back to the crash site to retrieve his motorcycle, where he eventually overhears Meadows conversing with his men, admitting that the military is behind the creation of the blob as a potential biological weapon, and their experiments to mutate a virus in space has now rendered some rather interesting consequences, such as the fact that it's grown at a geometric rate, and it's now more than 1,000 times larger than its original mass. Meadows dismisses the voiced concerns over the blob being unstoppable, and notes that they have the situation in hand. Brian then hears that Meg, Kevin, and Eddie are all trapped in the sewers over the intercom transmissions that Meadows and his soldiers are receiving, and Meadows decides to use them as an expendable bit of bait to help track the creature. Brian ends up fleeing the scene with soldiers giving chase, with Meadows declaring that the youth has been contaminated and he needs to be killed for public safety. Brian ends up heading into the sewers on his bike, still pursued by soldiers, searching for Meg and the boys. Meg is still being stalked through the sewers by the ever-growing blob, who ends up catching up to them at a large T-junction. Eddie ends up being snatched out of Meg's arms while her brother Kevin attempts to climb to safety. Kevin is able to slip through the small grated bars, but Meg, an adult size, is unable to, and the now massive blob is almost able to stand and reach her. But a set of soldiers end up entering the junction from the other end and open fire on the beast, quickly becoming its new focus. Megan instructs her brother to run to the town hall and get help, and then lets herself drop back into the water, continuing to try to run from the blob on foot and attempting to climb up into a sluice line to get to another tunnel. Brian is on that same tunnel line and manages to pick her up and help her out, barely outrunning the creature through the sewers on their motorcycle before crashing. They end up ditching the bike, where they run into a single injured soldier, it's played by Bill Moseley, who is carrying explosives. As they reach a manhole to the main town street, they call out for help to the military above. Meadows sees this and orders his men to seal the manhole cover up, even over the protests of his own people, trapping the survivors in the pipes with the beast. Brian ends up taking a rocket launcher from the injured soldier, and he blows open the manhole as well as the vehicle above, drawing military and the gathered townsfolk into the public square. Surrounded by hundreds of witnesses, Brian ends up holding a gun on Dr. Meadows and shouting to Briggs that all of this has been a lie. Briggs, to his credit, attempts to defuse the situation, while Meadows rants to his men that they need to shoot the boy.
Listen to me, Briggs. Think for a minute. Do you suppose an army of guys in plastic suits show up every time a meteor falls? Shoot him. That's a direct order. How do you think they got here so quick? How did they even know what to come? Shoot, damn it, shoot! I'll tell you how. That meteor is man-made. It's some kind of a germ warfare test. They fucked up. Don't try it!
Meadows is grabbed by the blob and pulled into the sewer, being partially consumed in the process and witnessed by the whole town. Scientist Jennings, as played by Robert Axelrod, is now in charge, and he orders the soldiers to kill the blob, attempting to injure it with their conventional weapons. This simply enrages the creature, and as they attempt to blow it up with explosives, a massive house-sized entity bursts its way through the asphalt street and begins to attack the populace at large. Reverend Meeker begins praying in the street, heralding this as the beginning of the apocalypse and quoting Revelations. In his zeal, he wanders next to a soldier attempting to hold the blob back with a flamethrower, and he ends up getting horrifically burned when the creature blocks a blast of flame and sends the gout sideways. Meg, running, sees Meeker fall, and she manages to douse him with a fire extinguisher, inadvertently causing the blob to retreat back from the cold. Briggs ends up rallying the remaining townsfolk at the town hall, and upon Meg's discovery, they begin to attempt to board up all entry points and push the beast back with blasts from fire extinguishers gathered from around the building. The power ends up being cut, and the blob slowly begins to envelop the sides, eventually sucking Briggs directly through the barricade. Brian runs up the street to the municipal garage, where the Ski Town's portable snowmaker truck is being serviced. Stealing it, he runs the machine on a crash course with the blob, launching streams of liquid nitrogen snow at it, which does begin to hurt the crawling terror. But then, enraged, it charges the truck and knocks it over, pinning Brian upside down in the cab. Meg, seeing that no one will help, takes it upon herself to lead the creature away from Brian, first by grabbing a dropped rifle and a bag of satchel charges. She then takes pot shots and screams at it, trying to get it close enough for her to use the charges to set off the truck's tank stores of nitrogen. She herself gets stuck hanging off the truck, but a now freed Brian is able to grab her, and they're able to run to safety as the charges detonate, and the blob is flash frozen by a wave of chemical ice. As the snow falls, Meg's family sees that Meg and Brian have survived the blast, and the townsfolk collectively gather up the crystallized blob pieces for storage at the local ice house, giving us a happy ending for the town. We then cut to an old-fashioned fire-and-brimstone tent revival being held in a remote field in the middle of America in summer, given by a now long-haired, horrifically disfigured, liquor-swilling Reverend Meeker, describing the apocalypse in a way that is similar to how the blob has itself attacked Arborville. when a parishioner finds him after the service and asks him, when will the day of reckoning actually come? He softly tells her, soon, madam, soon, and then pulls from his coat the original hinged mason jar that he took from the diner, containing a now thawed and wriggling piece of the blob, proclaiming that the Lord will give me a sign. Credits roll. Jeez, where do you even start with that? Well, here, let's kick off why I feel this is a better movie than the original. Now, I have to go out here and just blatantly state, I love the original 1958 offering. It's got its limited effects, its head-scratching character decisions that really anchor it into a great example of a classic B-movie. And it's able to overcome these so-called shortcomings and issues that it has with a lack of funds, mainly because, well, it's fun. Steve McQueen is so charming, charismatic, and cool. You just stop caring and you give yourself over to just enjoying the ride. And the model it puts forth is not a bad one. These same tropes get recycled almost beat for beat by the Kyoto Brothers' 1986 cult classic movie Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Solid. Right down to having grumpy John Vernon sub in for the grumpy teenage-hating police sergeant. Seriously, it's a gem. Go see it. The problem for me is twofold. First, with the original film, the pacing. For a movie that's 82 minutes long, we spend far too much time on trying to show the hot rod racing antics of these so-called teenagers. Seriously, your main character is a 28-year-old married McQueen. You could argue with me that it's supposed to show the recklessness of youth, or that it was supposed to be put in to appeal to teenagers, but I'm going to call a spade here. It's filler material. It's meant to stretch out the timeline of this movie. It doesn't further the plot, and it doesn't give us anything as an audience. It simply exists to occupy the space between when the teens drop off the old man Barney to Doc Hallen, and then filler until we get to the action with the blob becoming truly a menace to the town. When the doc sends the teens out to go back to the place where they picked up the body and see what else has happened there, that adds even more stretch in time, and it's completely unproductive for the main storyline. By contrast, within the first 20 minutes of Russell's 88 blob, we are just off to the races. In that time frame, the homeless gentleman is our initial victim. He's already discovered. Our would-be hero has already taken him to the hospital, where our hero and the doctor are then consumed. Boom, boom, boom. It's done. We are now moving right into the plot like a freight train. Second, the blob, while it still looks so beautiful in Technicolor, it could actually be a disturbing, scary concept of this organism that only exists to eat and grow and continue on. It can't be reasoned with, it can't be contained, it can't be stopped by conventional means. That is a terrifying concept. And yet, what we have on screen in front of us from the 1958 offering still comes off looking dark, and at times it's just really hard to see. This slow-moving wall of something that frankly looks like a tortoise could outrun. It's the same problem I have when I watch the old Universal monster films, and again, I stress, I love them, but if you're able to avoid the danger by simply ambling at a slow pace in any direction away from something like, let's say, the mummy, you can survive. It's not really terrifying. Heck, it even becomes a plot point in the 1990 Night of the Living Dead remake. It literally uses that with our lead heroine noting, you know, we could just walk past them. Anything that is a danger like that suddenly drops my ability to sort of suspend disbelief, because I just look at it and go, yeah, just walk away. Conversely, Russell's 88 version offers up a very hungry and seemingly semi-intelligent blob that is actively pursuing its prey, stalking its victims with great verb and intent.
Your call cannot
her! Get her, kill her!
He went down to the diner.
What I love about the remake is just how smartly it subverts conventional genre tropes. At the start of the film, the audience is set up to believe that it's Paul who's going to be our hero and love interest for the story, and that's really accentuated by that great gag where his buddy is buying the condoms and then claims, well, it's for my friend, to the pharmacist, and then of course he goes on the date to meet Meg, and it's her father who turns out to be the same guy who sold the condoms in the first place, and it's all played masterfully for laughs by the great late Art LaFleur. And that is based on a both urban legend, but according to director Chuck Russell, that actually happened to a friend back in the day. All of that said, it's a complete distraction, because within the first 20 minutes of the film, Paul is summarily devoured, and suddenly Brian finds himself deputized to be our story's hero and the new love interest for Meg. But that's not the only rule that the Blob brazenly decides to break. Up until this point, it would be rare to have a mainstream movie show something horrible happen to a child on screen. Sure, you'd put kids in danger in service to the story to ratchet up tension, but of course they're going to be saved at the nick of time, and it provides the audience some sort of rewarded relief in the process. But that's not to be found here. When they're running away from the theater and they find themselves pursued by the Blob through the sewers, Meg is desperately trying to save her little brother Kevin and his friend Eddie, and just when it looks like we're going to see the trio make a break for it at the last minute, we have that trope yet again hard subverted when Eddie is devoured in front of his friends instead of being saved by the authorities, which throws the audience off again, and it reminds them that this is not a film that is going to play by the rules. Russell has gone on record to state that his own favorite scene in the film is the aforementioned, emotionally scarring scene for me, the sink drain, noting that it covers all the bases. It builds the dread, it plays on the human emotional fear of sticking one's limb or hand out into the dark unknown, and then of course it plays upon the whole process of seeing something violent and disturbing when our dishwasher, George, again as played by Clayton Landy, is grabbed and grotesquely pulled down the drain himself, before then having the Blob burst out of the pipe and attempt to attack the other people in the room who have ran in to try to give aid. It's both comical and unsettling in the best of ways. It's a good scene, but honestly, I have to tell you, for my money, I actually like the very fleeting scene that occurs between the character Scott, as played by Ricky Paul Golden, and Vicky, as played by Erica Alaniak, as the couple who are making out and drinking at the Lover's Lane, right across from the hospital the Blob breaks out of. You know, perhaps I have some sort of emotional Tourette's, but there's so much made of by Scott's date with Vicky. He keeps saying, it's Vicky DeSoto. I mean, he puts so much emphasis on that. Where have I heard that kind of emphasis stressed before?
Hello? Yes, this is the original Homer Simpson. Who's this? The Debbie Pinson, who is the homecoming queen at high school? Yes, I'm still available.
No, he's not.
Marge, that was Debbie Pinson. Debbie Pinson.
No dating.
Oh.
Now, what I love is that in this scenario, Scott really thinks he's being suave. He thinks he's really making a solid move. He's plying his date with his air quotes special cherry coolers, which, when he travels from the front seat of his car to the back trunk where all his loot's carried, he's really just mixing a bunch of Hawaiian punch with vodka and strawberries. And by the time our young mixologist returns from his supplies to resume his necking session with Vicky, she has seemingly fallen asleep. Now, I'm not going to glorify anything about this, because there's no way to get around it. Yeah, absolutely. Scott's a creepy dude. He's very date-rapey here. Especially when he's leading up to it, where he's trying to touch the buttons on her blouse and she's not responding. But again, it's a perfect example of where we have a zig when we are expecting a zag. This movie does follow the 80s horror trope, where it plays out according to the rules. Sex, be it consensual or not, is going to be punished with a violent death. You know, you've seen one, you've seen them all. Teens in the throes of passion are suddenly going to find themselves on the pointy end of some psychopath's blade, or suddenly staring down a monster's maw. That happens here, but Scott gets outright stopped before he even starts, and that provides a really great jump scare. You know, you would initially think the couple is going to be attacked, where they're both awake and present and can see, it's the blob! But no, instead, Russell frames this with such a shock, because as Scott reaches in to cop what would become a very purloined feel, you get to watch him react in horror as the body of the oh-so-desired Ms. DeSoto suddenly melts before him, because the creature has already consumed Vicky off-camera while he was playing bartender, and now he's just inside of her skin, and that shell dissolves and immediately latches onto him and consumes him in the car's front seat. It's an awesome scene, it's a great jump scare, and it's some very, very ironic comeuppance all at the same time. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention the amazing acting that we get here, particularly from one Ms. Shawnee Smith, who really does excel as being that sort of cheerleader archetype, who then steps up to become really this movie's true hero. Yeah, Dylan's Brian is a hero in his own right, but he gets upstaged time and time again by Shawnee Smith's Meg. And he's even rescued at the very end by her, because a gun-toting, blob-facing Meg is the one who sets everything right. She sheds that goody-two-shoes facade, and she takes charge of all the action right from the start of this picture. That, and, once again for my money, the acting that Del Close provides here really steals the show. I mean, let's face it, every scene he's in, he's great. From that uncomfortable, simpering conversation he has with the boys in the pharmacy, to his drunken encounter with the blob on the street, Reverend Meeker is such a wild character, and it just feels so completely right. A man so imperfect, so broken, so disfigured, suddenly thinks that he's going to take it upon himself to believe that it's going to be he who's going to unleash a future blob-related apocalypse on an unsuspecting world, simply as a result of his already proverbial thin slice of cheese thoroughly falling off its cracker. It's a wild performance from Close, and I wish we got more of it here. But I'm going to say this, I know not everyone feels the same way about this film that I do. And frankly, that's okay, because that's exactly why we have things like The Sidecar.
Welcome to The Sidecar, y'all. It's so fucking here. Welcome to The Sidecar, all. We got what you wanna hear. Yep. Welcome to The Sidecar, y'all. It's so fucking here. Welcome to The Sidecar, all. We got what you wanna hear. Yep.
And riding in the sidecar with us today is the great John Seavey, host of the Half-Priced Horror Podcast. So rather than me just gassing on any further, let's just cut to the chase. John, what do you have to tell us about the blob today?
I'll be honest, I think Chris might have picked the wrong month for this one. That's not to say I don't love me a little slice of fun, silly 80s sci-fi horror goodness, but choosing 1988's The Blob as part of a remakes that are better than the original theme month pretty much directly invites comparisons to the original. And the 88 Blob isn't better than the original. Honestly, it's not even the best Blob remake of 1988. That would be Killer Clowns from Outer Space, which takes the same plot and substitutes pack of rampaging alien clowns for gelatinous blob. Now, full disclosure, I do not have an unbiased opinion here. The 1958 version of The Blob was the first horror movie I ever saw, back when I was about 6 years old and home video was just beginning to make all the films my parents saw in the drive-in available on demand. They rented it thinking we'd love the campy silliness of the 30-year-old teenagers and the goofy theme song and the hokey special effects, and were surprised when it absolutely terrified me to the point of nightmares. I love the original Blob, and I'd say nostalgia was coloring my perceptions unduly if not for the fact that it wound up in the Criterion Collection. But I really do believe that the original benefits from direct comparison more than you might think. Sure, it's amateurish, whereas the remake is slick and polished and has a real budget behind it instead of being a scrappy independent production, one of the first color independent films and a real inspiration to generations of producers, in fact. But it's got a lot of heart, and it makes some choices that I think give it more menace at times than the remake, even if it can't match all that wonderful 80s gore. And credit where it's due, it is wonderful 80s gore. The policeman's corpse mashing against the side of the phone booth? Quality. Quality jump scare. I remember that one being shown on a compilation video of great moments in horror not long after the movie came out. But take one of the key scenes from both movies, the discovery of the Blob itself. Both movies feature an old man discovering the crash site. The 80s movie overcomplicates the story by making the meteor secretly an American spacecraft, because government conspiracies were just coming into vogue back then and everything needed to be a conspiracy. And both movies feature the Blob unexpectedly lunging straight up in defiance of gravity and snagging the old man's hand. But the 80s movie immediately cuts away. That's a huge mistake, because the terror doesn't come from the immediate assault. The terror, as we see from the original, comes just afterward, when the old man first tries to scrape the substance off and discovers that it's adhering to his skin, and then moans. Not even screams, but moans. Like it hurts too much for him to muster up the strength for a full-throated scream, as the acidic goo begins to burn into his flesh and consume him. And while we're on the subject of aesthetic choices, don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with pink as a color, but knowing that the original Blob is that color red because it's actually a clear life form, and all the pigmentation comes from its digested victims? That's some bone-deep horror there. A plus, no notes. Olin Rowland gets to have a performance as the elderly man, one that's filled with terror and anxiety, and the heavy knowledge that his momentary curiosity is going to cost him his life in the most agonizing way possible. It's something the film devotes a little time to, allowing it to sit with us, whereas the remake just tries to get past it as quickly as possible to devote more time to the monster's rampage. I think that's a real mistake, especially because, look, there's no nice way to put this. There are a lot of plot contrivances in the remake that we're just supposed to ignore. Like Meg. According to this movie, Meg is in the hospital with the Blob. She watches it consume her boyfriend from no more than 2 feet away, literally within arm's reach. She faints dead away at the sight, and I'm not gonna blame her for that, there is some seriously awful stuff going on in this scene, very visceral and gory. But then the Blob apparently ignores her and leaves? What, does it have an appointment to get to? Is it worried about getting caught in the act? Of course, we all know that the answer is Meg has plot armor because she's the female lead, but that's the kind of thing a scrappy independent production made by amateur filmmakers can get away with, and the legendary Frank Darabont maybe can't so much. And there's a lot of that in the remake. The Blob pursues people when it's dramatically appropriate, then vanishes once the big action set piece is over. It screams at its prey like a red-tailed hawk despite being an overgrown amoeba with no vocal cords, it kills a kid but spares the main characters every single time, and in general it behaves exactly as the screenwriters need it to in any given scene. And to some extent, the presentation feels like, every time you begin to wonder about that kind of story problem, Russell and Darabont are there to say, hey, whoa, no fair, this is just a big budget version of a silly 50s drive-in movie. You can't hold us to any real standards. And if that's the case, I'd rather go and watch the actual 50s drive-in movie. It's got authenticity, it's got heart and pluck and a real can-do attitude that even extends to its special effects. Sure, they're a little hokey if you go for a 4K restored print that shows every last detail, but they're surprisingly believable. And to top it all off, the original has a theme song by the late, great Burt Bacharach. The remake has, Brave New Love by the Swedish hair metal band Alien. Not to diss Swedish hair metal, but I think I can rest my case here.
Ouch! Shots fired! J'accuse! I'm just kidding. It's all good. I like that John's giving me a run for my money. I'll concede his point, though. The opening scene with Olin Holland is far better for the reasons that John pointed out. We do get more time with that old man character. We get to see his painful and horrific experience at the start, rather than just cutting away. The balance, though, gets struck, I would argue, and that comes from us getting to see the Blob do more. He gets to devour far more people in unique and creative ways. See the couple at Lover's Lane, George and Fran, the projectionist, the manager, Eddie, so on. I would also push back a bit on the notion that Russell and Darabont were trying to create their version of a campy 80s drive-in B-movie. That, both due to the time and their rising stature in the industry in the late 80s, it allowed them to have the opportunity to use their big-budget means to make something new, by comparison to that scrappy independent work that Jack Harris had with his 1958 offering. And to me, at least as I've said on this show in the past, the movies you remake are the ones that were born of great ideas, and they just didn't have the means, or they didn't quite stick the landing when it came to creating the final product. I suspect that had money been no object, and that Jack Harris and director Irvin Yeworth, they would have gone on and done the 1950s equivalent of making their original offering bigger, flashier, scarier, better. But they did, at the time, what good independent filmmakers did. They innovated their project and worked with what they had. As for the logic of our film's menace consuming Paul, but not going after our main character of Meg, this one is kind of hard for me too, because yes, indeed, it is the trope of B-movie writing, where you don't have to apply logic in certain instances when it comes to your main characters, because if then, you'd have no story. I am willing to suspend my level of disbelief to go along for the campy ride, because honestly, in the back of my mind, even these films that we now look at as revered, the great films, they suffer from the same issues. Case in point, why don't we throw on Steven Spielberg's Jaws and get halfway through it and then just ask, why doesn't somebody call the Coast Guard? On the cinematic sweater that is the Blob, these are the types of strings that you just don't start pulling. But I have to say, John and I are both on the same wavelength when it comes to Killer Clowns from Outer Space, as well as the conspiracy theory here with that change to the original Blob itself. Wanting to make it more relevant to the Cold War, the concept of the Blob was an experimental bioweapon that the US government lost control of. That in itself is not a bad idea. The problem is, it really feels shoehorned in this offering. We could have done a lot with the military action, and you could have left out that convoluted conspiracy on top of things. Incidentally, I will throw out this. The biologic impossibility of the Blob as being a functional, giant bacterial entity has actually been explored in published works. There's a 2001 monograph called The Biology of Science Fiction Cinema, and the 1988 Blob is presented as moving way too fast, and it would be unable to create and project pseudopod tentacles on command without having a set of muscles to control its entire being, unless of course it was categorized as an amoeboid-like entity. The book also points out that the scientists in the film first refer to it as a bacterium, and then when they discuss it, they start talking about it as a mutated virus, and then later as a plasmid from its time and space, which I have to agree, yeah, you gotta pick a lane on that. All that said though, between John and myself, a difference of opinion here, thankfully, is not a difference of principle, because I think I can speak on John's behalf when I clearly say, obviously, we both enjoy the original Blob, and we can at least agree on the overall fun of the concept itself. And that said, nice job, sir. I can hear you folks out there, though. Chris, how was the Blob received? Well, remember when I mentioned that TriStar had stepped in to take over the distribution of the movie when the first studio backed out? The new studio thought it would be a wiser approach to market this monster film as a simple tease. They would never actually show the Blob or any of the cool special effects in any of the promotions, trailers, or even industry trades, opting instead to show just large numbers of people simply running away screaming. And they couched all of this as part of a very weird and generic campaign, where they would say, on all the print, terror has no shape. Audience members didn't know what to make of it as it was coming out, and critics really didn't know what to make of it either. Variety's Dawes spoke well of the film, noting in his review that some 30 years after the campy, low-budget original became a cult fave, The Blob is back here with a vengeance. Updated with some awesome, no-expenses-spared special effects and a feisty female hero, this horrific outing should prove thoroughly satisfying for fans of the genre. Well, he was one of the few, because Janet Maslin of the New York Times gave it a rather backhanded compliment, but then quickly noted it was not going to be as remembered like its progenitor. Noting in her review, modern technology has yielded at least one definite advance over the last 30 years, a better blob. Whereas the original 1958 model was a rolling heap of silicone, it did a little more than wobble and eat, the updated blob is infinitely more advanced. It can climb to the ceiling, it can plop down on anyone below, it can choose its victims mischievously, rather than on its predecessor's sort of catch-as-catch-can basis. It plays practical jokes. It can even overtake, subdue, and digest its prey right before the audience's eyes. But this is progress after a fashion. So by any reasonable standard, Chuck Russell's current blob is new and improved. It's more of a professional effort in every way. The special effects truly look sickeningly good. And the actors show signs of being able to act, which honestly could not be said of any member of the original cast, not even Steve McQueen, who was Stephen McQueen then and was appearing in his first major film role. And yet, for reasons having nothing to do with merit, the 1958 film has earned a place in history. The remake, enterprising as it is, won't do the same. The gist was the same in multiple publications. It looks better, but it's lacking heart. With a lackluster setup, The Blob ended up oozing its way into theaters on August 5th, 1988, competing against heavy hitters like Cocktail, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Die Hard, Coming to America, A Fish Called Wanda, Midnight Run, and Big. It was able to barely close out in 8th place by the time the weekend wrapped. Audiences didn't know what to make of it, and they voted with their feet and wallets. And by the end of its theatrical run, The Blob had only earned about $8 million against its $10 million budget. Russell took the lack of success very personally, and would later reflect that perhaps he and Darabont had made the movie too silly, too funny, and perhaps they should have focused on dialing up more of the horrific aspects. The film did not serve as a personal setback, though, for either of their careers, but it stung nonetheless. Well, like so many things we cover here, as the years rolled on, the 1988 Blob has moved on to become a cult film. It was a popular VHS rental, and it continued to pick up new fans as subsequent generations of movie viewers discovered its humor and its breakneck pacing, recognizing its quality, especially with the visual effects, and most of them, at least like I do, were reveling in the breaking of established horror rules. In my opinion, and I've said this before, if you like a remake, you should see it first as serving as a gateway to get back and watch the originals, which allows for you to have appreciation of American classic film in general. If you'd seen the original film first, The Blob 88 shows a new generation taking the story that they loved into a new era, and it allows for some really wild fun. And either way, you get all of that blob action that you could want, so what's not to like? Since 1988, The Blob has actually had multiple filmmakers flirting with the notion of creating yet another remake for a more modern audience. Post his time making The Devil's Rejects, musician-turned-filmmaker Rob Zombie has kicked around the concept of doing his version of The Blob before all of that completely fell through. I'm not gonna lie, I am not disappointed by that choice. But action director Simon West had secured the rights from Jack Harris and got the backing of the studio Goldcrest Films, and was in the process of getting the remake together in 2015. But that's when production itself hit a snag, when Harris died in 2017, leaving the rights to The Blob in limbo. You see, it's funny, West claims he still has the rights, but Harris's estate now begs to differ. Throw in the mess that COVID-19 caused, and we are without a new film for a new age at this moment. West has opined in interviews that he felt a modern CGI would absolutely help a fully realized potential of the Blob, and he wanted to create a world that would be totally believable, immersive, and emotionally satisfying, noting that he was thrilled to introduce an enduring icon to a wider audience and a whole new era of fans. He also floated having new origins for the Blob. Now, it would be coming from the bowels of the Earth, teasing the involvement of one Samuel L. Jackson, so, you know, perhaps there is something interesting on the horizon. Or not. Either way, we have three films to date, and all of them offer up fun in their own right, so I'll take it. The version of the Blob screened here at the LSCE was the 2019 Scream Factory Collector's Edition Blu-ray, and that comes loaded with features. Pulling out all of the stops, the good folks at Scream Factory delivered an extensive two-part interview with director Chuck Russell, and then provided a series of interviews with production designer Craig Stearns, special effects creators Chris Gilman, Peter Abrahamson, Mark Sektrakian, and Tony Gardner, as well as cinematographer Mark Irwin, and actors Candy Clark, Jeffrey DeMunn, Bill Moseley, and Donovan Leitch, plus new audio commentary tracks from Russell, Irwin, and Gardner, as well as providing a separate audio commentary track for actress Shawnee Smith. And, just for grins, Scream Factory has also included the original commentary track from both Russell and producer Turek from the previous DVD release. Throw in some behind-the-scenes making-ofs, theatrical trailers, and TV spots, plus a full still gallery, and you got yourself more Blob fun than you can shake a stick at. Now, all of this could be yours from Amazon today for the low, low price of only $21.33, which I would argue is a straight-up steal. Now, remember, folks, we don't get anything here at the LSCE for telling you where to buy anything. We just feel in this day and age, especially where streaming services can make your content simply disappear overnight, that it's ever so important to keep supporting physical media, so that these fine companies who own the rights to these films that we love keep releasing them for our consumption. And after all, at the end of the day, isn't that what this is all about? Getting more of that content that you know and love? Besides, The Blob is such a fun, goofy, grotesque romp, how could you go wrong? So, I say again, what are you waiting for? Get out there and get yourself a copy of The Blob today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. We do hope you will be back next time as Superior Remake Summer rolls on, so be sure to join us next month. I would again like to take the opportunity to thank Mr. John Seavey, host of the Half-Priced Horror Podcast, for his contribution to the sidecar today. Please be sure to check out his Half-Priced Horror Podcast, where you can find a direct link to it both on our website and in this episode's show notes. If you like what we're doing here, that would be the LSCE Dachshunds and myself, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts and hit that subscribe button. Or hey, just do that to wherever you're listening to us on. Did you leave us a fun review? Hell, I'll read it here and give you a little shout-out on the show. Just think of it as my way of saying thank you for recognizing our love of cinema. Please, swing by and check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. I'm proud to say that we are on Amazon Music, so if you have an account, you can simply say, "Hey, Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured both on Good Pods and Podchaser. Those are some excellent podcast databases for listeners and creators alike. Find us there, give us a follow and a review if you could please, and hey, feel free to like any of the lists that we're a part of to give us a boost in the old rankings. The more reviews and the increased likes, that affects those marvelous algorithms, and it makes us more searchable. And then, we can share more of these films with more people. And you want to do that, don't you? Of course you do! If you have any questions for us, any comments, any movies you want us to cover, anything you thought I got wrong, well, we want to hear from you. Please send us an email or an audio clip to LindenStreetCinemaExperience@gmail.com. Do you love social media? Hey, we use it here. You can follow us on Twitter at LSCEP, or you can find us on Instagram at LSCE_podcast. So until next time, please take care out there. Everybody stay healthy and well. And remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.